Swung on, lined to deep left field. It is gone! Hit well. Deep right. Batista's going to wave goodbye. Start the fireworks show.
This is the official Covering the Corner podcast, episode 176. I'm your host, Matt Lyons, and in this week's episode, we'll have some meatballs, some fun little things that happened over the last week of baseball. Talk about Nick Sandlin and how very good he is immediately coming up. Talk about Roberto Perez breaking his finger, playing through it, and then now he's on the injured list, and Rene Rivera is in, and what's going on back there, and how well Cleveland can kind of just survive without him. Talk about Cleveland's place in the AL Central and the whole state of the division, which they find themselves in a probably advantageous position, considering where everything else is, considering where we thought they'd be coming into the year. And we'll preview the series coming up against the Cubs and Mariners, a couple of new teams they didn't play last year for once after playing the Central so many times over the first month. Joining me for all that and more, another Mr. Merritt Rolfing. Merritt, how you doing?
Great. Looking forward to finishing up this podcast so I can watch the wonderful 2010 film Wall Street Money Never Sleeps.
It's always good to start a podcast about how excited you are when it's over. So you can watch a movie from like 6 years ago.
It's 11 years ago, first of all.
That's the best way to start off, to get people interested.
Really, yes. I mean, come on, look at this movie, right? We're 133 minutes long. I mean, Michael Douglas, Shia LaBeouf. Somehow this cost $70 million to make.
Shia LaBeouf is expensive. He's not
cheap. I guess so.
2009? That's peak Shia LaBeouf. That
2010.
Is.
So yeah, this is post all the great fame of the Transformers and Transformers 2 and Transformers Afterbirth, I think is another one of them.
And, yeah, getting Shia LaBeouf then is like the equivalent of what Albert Pujols signed.
Because I mean, getting Michael Douglas in 1987, basically, huh? Money never right, sleeps, there baby.
There you go.
So yeah, that's my life.
Yeah. So in between watching old Wall Street movies, which
it's not that old, man.
Well, I mean, oldest. It's 10 years now. That's older than you think.
I was watching The Thin Man last night, which I got to tell you, boring. And that's from 1942 or something. And that's just not my vibe. That's an old movie, pal.
I've been watching also very up-to-date things, which is subscribed to, what is that one, Paramount Plus? Mainly just for old Nickelodeon stuff, but they have a Smithsonian channel.
Steal my buddy's subscription to that. Pretty good.
Yeah, they have the Smithsonian stuff, which is really cool. I was watching about the Apollo launches, and that was neat. In between baseball games, especially since the last 2 days now at this point, we haven't had any. But
absolute garbage.
Absolute terrible. But you know what we have had, Merritt?
Tell me. Oh, right.
Meatball. We've had some meatballs because we've had games playing. Cleveland, they did went 6-1 over the last week, which was, I mean, the one loss is a pretty big one. It was being no hit by Wade Miley, but in between that, they did do some stuff. So, Merritt, what's your meatball this week?
Oh, I'm going first. All right. So the most consequential trade in recent Cleveland history, consequential is a big word, doing a lot of heavy lifting on this one, was what? What's the one that we kvetch about the most?
I'm trying. Is it good or bad? Is consequential?
Bad. Mostly.
I mean, Lindor Carrasco, right? That's the one I'm still angry
about. I was thinking more the Jake Bauer Shigandy Diaz trade.
Oh yeah, that one's terrible.
Well, I submit to you the fact that they've done it. They've found a new Yandy Diaz, and he's better than before. And today we're going to talk about Harold Ramirez. Now, yes. You laugh. However, Harold Ramirez has the third hardest hit ball on the entire team so far this year at 114.5 miles per hour. He has the fourth highest average exit velocity. Granted, only 18 batted ball events, but still, that's not bad. And, much like our own beloved Yandy Diaz, he has an average launch angle right there at negative 5.9 degrees. So,
right in the Yandy zone.
What I'm telling you, but also he's fast, which is kind of neat. What I'm telling you is they've done it. They found Harold Ramirez. They found their starting center fielder. I'm not going to complain about him being a starting center fielder for quite a while at this point because he's fast and hits the ball hard. And I'm a huge sucker for guys who are just physically good at things, I guess. Now we're only talking about a couple of games here. He hasn't had a hit since Kansas City. But then again, no one got any hits on Friday, so we just throw that game out, and then he didn't even play on Saturday. So what are we to say here? What are we to do? How are we to look at this? He's probably good. What I'm saying is he's good. So there you go.
Yeah, and you mentioned, too, like the not many batted ball events, but you can take max exit velocity. Like that matters more than – maybe not more, but like everybody gets caught up in average. But if you can hit one ball, how hard did he hit it? Like 114, something like that. But yeah, if you can hit one that hard, I mean, the chances are pretty good you're going to do it again and again. It's better than hitting like a bunch of them at 89 and having a high hard hit rate. If you can hit a bunch of them over 100, then you're doing good. And that's always been a thing with Harold too, is like, everybody knows he hits the ball hard. It's like you said, he's Yandy Diaz. He hits the ball hard, but his launch angle sucks.
Now, I'm not going to get into his plate discipline or the fact that he doesn't take any walks. That seems like it's muddling the conversation, but yeah, the top five are, top five are 114.9, 114.7.5 is Ramirez. And then you drop all the way down to 111.8 with Jose Ramirez. Now, looking at things like barrels per plate appearance is a different conversation, because then we run into things like Rene Rivera somehow being number one because he has like three plate appearances.
But I think it was pretty good in a couple of them. So I think it was 2 for 3 in that one game. But
superstar in the making, Harold Ramirez, or maybe just decent role player if he learned to take a walk. We'll see how it goes. The eyes are open on Harold Ramirez.
I mean, I don't mind him over Ahmed Rosario in center field. Like, with what they have, I'm perfectly fine. I guess that leaves Jordan Luplow out, which kind of sucks, but I am fine with Harold Ramirez starting in center field at some point. I would like to see Ramirez stay there and then Bo Naylor come up and have a lineup of Rosario, Ramirez, Naylor. Or just go back and forth.
Just do 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, yeah. 3. Or
there you go. Or Ramirez, Rosario, Naylor. I want that lineup.
Or go like Naylor, Ramirez, Rosario, Ramirez, Naylor. Whatever. Just have fun with it. Who cares, guys?
And come then on. Just Bowers at the end.
Yeah, just Bowers. Ah, damn.
So mine this week is, but mine is about on Saturday when after the no hitter, because that was not very good. But entering the game on Saturday, Cleveland had the third worst weighted pitch value against changeups, which was -10.8, which that's a cumulative stat. It basically means like before an at bat or before a pitch, this was the potential value, and after the pitch, depending on what happened, this is how it changed. And Cleveland is just deep in the negatives. They've seen 15.2% of changeups. The next closest was 13.5. So it's clearly something that teams are using against them. And it was really effective because they've been terrible about them all year long. I wrote about it even a couple of weeks ago.
Years, even, it seems,
and
like.
Yeah, years. It's just, I mean, again, it's the 2019 Lucas Giolito said they didn't adjust to it and they just continued to be bad against them. But on Saturday, they faced Luis Castillo, who is off to a terrible start, but he's also has one of the best changeups in baseball. I think even this year, it's still not that bad. He threw it 24 times. They saw 6 from Carson Fulmer. Of those 20, they only swung and missed twice. They put 8 in play and fouled off 10 of them, which I think is it's pretty good. That's considering where they've been and who that pitcher was that they were facing, and they put so many balls in play. That's at least a tiny bit encouraging. It's only one game compared to the 30 where they've been awful against changeups, but it was nice to see him, first of all, coming off a no-hitter like that, and then second of all, against a pitcher that should have just dismantled them with how he throws the ball. But they still did all right. Jose Ramirez had a single off a low changeup in the 8th. Cesar Hernandez's triple was also off a changeup, so that's my little fun thing, is the fact that they hit all these changeups and they finally hit a ball that they've been so bad against all year long.
It's the bounce back that's just so pleasant, because like everything, you could just have read that and gone, they're just going to get annihilated tomorrow too. The good pitcher is pitching. Ah, crap. But no, actually they just beat him up, just bludgeoned him all around, and it was very satisfying. And as I said before, it sucks to get no hit, but at the end of the day, it's just a loss. And I figure once it's happened to you once in a year, you're like, well, I guess that's a stinker, huh, guys? Let's, I guess, come back out and bounce back on it. But
And one thing I definitely noticed for sure is that following a no-hitter is way less fun than following a perfect game, because even when they were getting perfect gamed by Carlos Rodon, it was still fun to follow because it's so much more tense. Like, a no-hitter is almost just nothing anymore. It happens multiple times a year, but following a perfect game until the last couple outs, yeah, it was really fun. Like, I think part of that also was because it was in Chicago, so it was more tense and the crowd was into it, but I think following a perfect game is way more. I'd rather be perfect gamed than, I mean, win 1-0, I think, is more exciting, but
I would prefer the team I like win, personally.
Well, I mean, if they're fine, they'd rather watch a perfect game than, because there's only been 23 of those. There's been plenty of baseball wins, man. Teams do that occasionally, but I don't know. I'd still rather win. But I mean, if they were like already 20 games up in the division or something crazy, I'd rather just see them be perfect gamed and then win like a 1-0 game that doesn't matter. But not be no hit, because that's not fun. Even if it is just one loss in the loss column, it's still a very annoying loss in the loss column.
We haven't like 300 times now, like, in Major League history, which is crazy to think that 5 haven't already this year. That's a certain amount of percent point.
That is a number, yeah. I think the White Sox alone are like
1.8% or something like that. I don't know, yeah.
Yeah, the White Sox have done a bunch of those on their own. But so yeah, one person who did come up this week, or he came up, what was it, a couple of weeks ago, is Nick Salen, who was a very interesting
I just wrote about him like 2 days ago. What do you mean a couple weeks ago?
Well, I mean, he came up when Logan Allen was optioned. He didn't pitch.
Oh, came up into the team, not came up in the zeitgeist. I got you.
All right. Yeah. April 29th is when he was added to when Logan Allen was just terrible, which, by the way, he was bad again in AAA. But yeah, this is a guy who it's cool that he's here now, but he was a guy that it looked like he was going to be up almost in the majors in his rookie season, his professional debut season, because he rocketed up to AA in 2018. The year he was drafted, AAA in 2019, and that season was cut short because of surgery. Obviously, last year he lost it all because of the pandemic, and they didn't want to bring him up straight to the majors. But he's here now. He's with Cleveland. He's been amazing. As you said, you wrote about it. He's pitched 4.1 innings, no earned runs, 4 strikeouts, a lot of weak contact. He's fun to watch just because, one, he's good, and two, he has such a weird arm motion that it's fun to watch, and especially comparing it to some of the other pitchers like Cal Quantrill, who throws way overhead and all this other stuff. I think he's going to be really good this season. I don't think he's going to be going down again. But
I was thinking about this the other day. There was an article, I don't know, last October sometime, just talking about the Rays and their bullpen arsenal, basically, and how in any given what they did is some guy just overlaid all the different arm points from where a pitch may be coming at you, depending on who's pitching during the game, and it was basically like an entire rainbow of arm angles, because it was lefties and righties and side armers and submariners and overhead guys and three-quarter guys, obviously. And it's one of the little things that I think doesn't get talked about a lot when it comes to pitching being hard to hit, I guess, because you get used to this release point, and like, yeah, you'll look at someone like Shane Bieber, and his release point's a pinprick, basically. But then all of a sudden you bring someone else in, and like, you're used to seeing the ball here, and all of a sudden it's all down over here. Now, most pitches obviously are doing kind of a three-quarter thing. But now, he's so much fun to watch. I when I wrote about that article, I mentioned that guy on the Giants who like releases the ball like his knuckles are scraping the ground as he releases the ball, basically, which is really, really cool. I love a true submariner. But Chandler's great, you know, and like he has a very fun complimentary east-west pitch mix. He's definitely somewhere you could start complaining, like, oh, if only he could throw an X or a Y, he'd be absolutely unhittable. It's like, he's already really hard to hit. Like, who cares? Like, shoot. He throws a quote-unquote sinker or two-seamer, but it moves very hard horizontally, simply because his ER angle doesn't allow for a lot of drop. So you could complain about him not having a lot of drop on his sinker. But again, who cares? His slider looks like it rises, for God's sake. So
it does. I'm watching the GIF in your article. It's just... it's awesome. It like moves the two up. Pitches, like, they're so weird. Like, I know it technically can't do that, but it obviously looks like it is. And
yeah, like it's just, and so it's, but that pairing is just very hard. It's going to be very, but it's going to bedevil people. And he's at this point the fourth or fifth or sixth best reliever they have. It seems like it took the team a few years to finally pull it off, but it's very obvious that they've been building this kind of bullpen. And then, of course, you luck into a reclamation project from Brian Shaw, and it just adds to it. So he really is going to make things, because, you know, like we got really used to the kind of the 1-2-3 or just the back two in Karinchak and Class A plus whoever else is going to be, like Whitgren or whoever. But people were mentioning this in the comments of my article. I don't read the comments. What are you talking about? About how they have two legit 7-8-9s basically at this point.
Yeah. And if you took like Class A, Karinchak, and Shaw out of the picture, like that comment said, like if you have, I don't know, Whitgren, Maton, and Sandlin, that's another really good 1-2-3.
Exactly.
Or, multiple. I mean, Whitgren's been bad so far, but I mean, I don't think he's going to be that bad forever. And so is Maton, if he can get his shit under control. And I think he can be good too, but that's another 1-2-3 you have, which is amazing.
But then even, you know, I mean, Henches, depending on where he ends up, he's got a big, powerful arm. And Quantrill, I think, is a pretty valuable reliever. You mentioned Maton. I've had Trevor Stephan. Maybe. I don't know. We'll find out. Like, that's the thing. Like we have a sample size with Stephan of like 10 innings. So same thing. We have like, what, 4 innings or something with Sandlin. So
yeah, Sandlin's your title is perfect because it's what he is. Like you can immediately tell he's really good. Like, I don't know if it'll last forever, but his immediate impact has been so good.
It's how are you going to hit that? Like, honestly, like there's some pitchers whose repertoire kind of runs into itself. And there's some who just like someone like Shaw or even Class A, like their repertoire is cutter slider. And you're like, those move the same. I don't know how that's, I mean, Class A obviously makes sense because it was 100 miles an hour. Shaw now throws 97 and he just throws a very good cutter, like Karinchak, where his fastball and his curveball complement each other perfectly, the same exact thing's happening here with Sandlin. So he's able to create just tunneling, and you literally have to pick one way or the other and just hope for the best. And if he becomes kind of a 50-50 pitcher where he throws them half the time and half the time, it's going to be hell for hitters. It's going to cause some heartbreak eventually because he's going to give up a couple of, you know.
Once they guess right, then they're going to, yeah.
Yeah, he's going to hang a cement mixer, and people like to hit sinkers. So the thing is, he throws through pitches that when you throw them poorly, they go a very long way. But he just has to not do that, and he'll be fine. There you go.
And am I crazier? Does he like? I know he's not a submariner because he's too high up, but he does like the little flick with the wrist. Like he's not a typical sidearmer, right? Like he puts a little stank on it when he pitches it.
Oh, I mean, he's got that weird little kind of crouch down thing too, so it just seems lower than like the release point is lower than just a normal sidearmer, but
because it's like he's under the ball when he's releasing almost. Yeah. Weird compared to like, yeah. Like
other. I think where he just gets that massive horizontal movement, the kind of bizarre. Seems like it's running uphill on you with the slider. That's such a cool pitch.
Yeah, it is. He's going to be throwing a bunch. And one thing, I mean, it depends on who's going to be throwing to now. Like in his first start, I think he was throwing to Perez in that gif because he was still there at that point. But no, it was actually Hedges. But that's going to be thrown to a lot more now is Austin Hedges because Roberto Perez, he hurt his finger middle of last month when, for some reason, all James Karinchak throws is a fastball and a curveball, but they got their signs mixed up. And that would look terrifying because I can't imagine, first of all, a ball coming at you when it's either a fastball or a curveball is scary enough, but not knowing which is which, because he was looking for a curveball, but it was a fastball, and he ended up just basically standing up and trying not to get hit somewhere without padding. And ended up
getting his hand.
he actually broke his finger and then played through it for a couple weeks and then decided that's not a good idea. So now he's going to be out. The way that Terry Francona put it was it's not weeks, it's months, which sounds like, I mean, there's only so many months in a baseball season, so it's going to be a pretty big chunk of time, I think,
Roberto Perez is gone. 10 to 12 weeks. So, I mean, he'll probably be back by the All-Star break, which is a long time, and which sucks because like he was having, not in terms of results, but at the plate, he was having a very good process here. Really. He was hitting the ball hard. He wasn't hitting the ball as often, but when he did hit the ball, he was hitting it very hard, so... it's a shame to have him to lose him. It's funny to say that now because we had this exact same conversation in 2016.
I mean, yeah, when it was Yan Gomes that was
injured.
It's kind of the same thing because they have Austin Hedges who's younger. The ages, I think, actually might almost be exact because Austin Hedges is 28 and Roberto Perez is 32 now. I think Roberto was like 1 year younger. But yeah, it's kind of the same thing. We questioned, I think we understood why they had 8 million. Tied up in catchers when their payroll is only 50 million. But this is exactly why they have Austin Hedges, who I think I said at the time of the trade is like, he is just a younger Roberto Perez. He's a really good guy behind the plate. He's terrible on offense, but it was pretty evident in Cleveland or in San Diego that he could lead a pitching staff. And I think he's at this point, I mean, he's has a 22 WRC plus, so he's not going to hit anything, but he's been really good defensively. Just the few games he's covered for Perez. And since he's been injured now, they brought up Rene Rivera. They actually signed him. It was like the day after the injury, and then nobody seemed to think it was related, weirdly enough.
Seems
but
fine. Everyone said, fine. Yeah.
Yeah, no, they said they were totally working on it before. It's fine. This wasn't related whatsoever, but it just happened to be Rene Rivera was up when Roberto Perez eventually went in the IL, and that's where he is now. He came up. He was really good for a couple of games. So I'm assuming we'll see Hedges pretty much almost every day except for night games after day or day games after night games. Yeah. Something like that, which we saw on Saturday cause it was a day game, but I think they'll be probably fine. I feel like they could survive their pitch and the data they have for their catchers, I think is so good. I mean, and obviously Roberto is a big part of that, but everyone who comes through, like all the pitchers, catchers, whoever always says like they have all this good data. And I don't think that's Roberto all on his own. I think somewhere along the line, somebody is getting them a lot of good scouting information and, they just have these guys like Hedges. They know who can handle it the same way Roberto can and get it to the pitcher. So,
yeah, I think this is one of the reasons. And we've talked about this several times before now. Like Hedges is they spend the money, they invest the resources into finding catchers because they know. And I mean, everyone knows that it's an unquantifiable thing, basically.
Yeah, and I'm sure somewhere they have something that quantifies it. But I mean, for us, it's unquantifiable,
right? Exactly. But it's difficult, I guess, or it's a very hard to easily quantify, I guess. It's lots of moving parts and all these different things and managing just things like everything from the pitch mix to the, you know, calling the game and all that crap. just all the way down to framing and everything like that too. So, but listen, I mean, they made the invest. They traded for him for a reason, and I mean, apparently this year he's bad at framing, and last year he was mediocre at framing, but the previous years he was always very, very good. So I'm going to believe those numbers more.
I'm going to believe the ones that fit to my story, which is...
Well, the ones where that are any level of sample size.
Right.
Yeah, is my real take. But yes, exactly. Yeah, these ones make me feel better, so I will listen to that. Yeah, because like he goes 17, he's 95th in framing runs. 2018, he's down at 71st percentile. Back in 100th percentile in 2019, 57th in 2020. And now in the 10th percentile in 2021, but he's also caught like four games. So
yeah, I wonder if this is even more less quantifiable. But I wonder if like different pitchers require different framing styles. Like if there's something about a way a staff throws, or like the certain stuff you have, if it's harder or easier to frame. Like if compared to what Hedges had in San Diego, maybe it's a little more difficult to adjust. And then he's like getting there. But also, I mean, it's what 60 games compared to 300. So I'm with you. I think the bigger sample size is probably the right one here, but I do wonder if there's like a thing, like if it's different framing correctly for each pitcher, because we know you can't just grab a ball and fling it in the middle of the zone and it'll count as framing. Like it's all about subtle little things you do with framing. And if the balls come in differently, if you get your signs crossed up and you don't know what's going on, then it's going to affect the framing. But
I've read an article about this like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, comparing like Gomes and Perez, and like I just remember discovering that, and I don't know if this was which way this went, because it could have been like the pitchers that one catches versus the other, but like one was better at framing on the edge, on the like the sides of the zone, as opposed to the top and the bottom. And I think part of the two was Gomes just taller than Perez is, so maybe that had something to do with his being able to frame high pitches a bit better. But also again, like Perez was only ever catching what I don't know.
He was only catching Trevor Bauer at one point.
Yeah, Trevor Bauer, and then they catch. But then obviously we had a whole season, like most of a season of him too. So, yeah, I don't know. It's got to be. It probably has something to do with the pitch mix of what you're facing, and then also knowing the pitchers is important. I mean, we saw how important that was when he got crossed up by goddamn James Karinczak.
Which is it's not even the first time. That was the first time, but it wasn't the only time.
No, it's happened several times.
And since they talked about it for a while during one game, and were like saying things, going back to the dugout and laughing about it. And Roberto was saying something to Terry Francona in the dugout, and they laughed about it. So I would kill to know what that conversation was like. Like what is going on there that makes it so confusing with two signs? If Karinczak just refuses to maybe throw the thing he wasn't called for, and he was doing it, I don't know, but. I would love to know.
Forgets. Like, yeah. Two's what?
A slider? I don't have a slider. All right, here we go.
Splitter? That's a weird one. All right.
Spitball? Can we do that?
Is that legal? I'm a knuckleballer now? You got it, Bebo. All right, let's do this.
I'd love to somebody just, like, break out a knuckleball. Because, I mean, like, Zach Greinke does an Ephus once in a while. That's always fun. I'd love to see, like, James Karinczak just bust out a knuckleball.
Matt, we need a knuckleballer back in Major League Baseball.
We don't have any right now, right?
None. There's not a single one anywhere. The last one was that guy in Boston. Not Wakefield, the other one. Because I think we were Wakefield, then R.A. Dickey, and then we had the other guy. And that was it.
Was it Lowe? I can't remember his first name. But
no. I think his name started with a W. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, though. But yeah, it's just sad because it's probably the greatest art in all of Major League Baseball, because it just takes such a weird head to just be able to just go, it'll be fine, 20, you know, 100 times a game, whatever. You know, I was like, where's this going? I don't know, whatever.
Who knows? We'll find out when it gets there.
Hey, it could go 400 feet the other direction or not. So I don't know. I mean,
especially now when everybody's so keyed up on fastballs, you'd think that.
Well, and now with the ball being lighter too, like year specifically, oh man, a knuckleballer would feast. He probably would have Cy Young, R.A. Dickey style.
Yeah. Which, again, that alone is crazy that R.A. Dickey, I mean, it's the pitching atmosphere wasn't quite the same as it is right now, but the fact that he won it in the 2010s is
wild. That was
wild,
really weird. Yeah. Very strange.
And then the Mets or the Blue Jays traded him for way too much. And then
Syndergaard, another pitcher, and then a hitter too, I think. It was a lot.
It was not a good trade for them, but.
No, really did really kind of shorten that little window they had there. But
Tiny little window.
Yeah, you got to try to win.
Now, if we want to talk closing windows, man, we have, I think a lot of people sort of thought Cleveland's was, if not closing, then it was being propped up by sticks and maybe would be open to more in a couple of years. Like this is supposed to be a transition year, but where they're sitting now is not a bad place. 18-14, they're a game back of the White Sox. They play the White Sox and Twins again coming up. They have a little West Coast road trip, then they come back and play them more. But, I mean, also, every other team has just had such bad luck. I think Roberto Perez has been the worst thing for Cleveland, but the White Sox, Eloy Jimenez died, and then they had a funeral for him on opening day. Luis Robert is injured now. Lucas Giolito just looks average, or looks mortal at this point. They're basically just being propped up by Yermin Mercedes, who, I mean, he's fun and all, but he's clearly outperforming everything.
Yeah, 450 batted or something like that.
That's
going
to come down quite a bit, I think. Then Tony La Russa has just been an absolute disaster. He kept Lucas Giolito too far, too long in a game. Didn't realize he was gassed. Didn't know the rule. Admitted it after the game that he didn't know that you could. I mean, it's an obscure rule, but if you have a pitcher with the second inning or the extra inning rule, you can have a batter run for him and still use him as a pitcher. But he didn't seem to know that. Nobody in the dugout knew. Which I saw somebody on Twitter point out that it might actually be that, like, people did know, but they didn't feel like they could tell Tony La Russa and make him feel like he was wrong, which is, I think, even kind of a worse thing if that's the case. But he's just been an absolute dumpster fire there, which is not a surprise. I don't know anybody that thought it would go well. But
it's wild that he's pitched Evan Marshall as much as he has, quite honestly. I just, like, because that's the thing. Like, you mentioned, obviously, with the dear departed.
May he rest.
May he rest. And obviously with Luis Robert getting hurt, but like the thing, you know, the offense is still holding together. It looks at this point it's now above average as far as you go down to the OPSs and whatnot. Your interstate will come crashing down. The pitching looks great. I mean, obviously Giolito looks average, but Keuchel is strong, and I feel like there's going to be a little bit of a return to median with Carlos Rodon, but like Cease looks strong, but their use of their bullpen is stupid, and it's been really game saving for a lot of teams, I think, because there's no reason why Evan Marshall should have 13.1 innings pitched.
I mean, they have that. They have Leury García playing too much in center field. They have, I mean, that's part of just because everybody's injured, but they're also using him so much compared to, like,
isn't Billy Hamilton on this team?
He is, yeah, he gets a lot of play there too. Yeah. Like, he's
okay.
He's like Terry Francona on steroids of all the bad decisions that he made, but they're all way, way worse. Like, he's overusing Leury García. Like I said, Evan Marshall, he's set into these bullpen roles. He doesn't know when to take out his starter. It's just everything is just so bad and so predictable.
Think it was someone on Twitter who said that Billy Hamilton is the absolute worst person you could possibly give. What's his name? Tony La Russa.
Yeah, him and they're both.
What a bad idea, man. Man, it's so bad. I love it. But yeah, it really, like you said, the whole division is absolutely wide open. I don't know if it's open to the Twins. Like, they just can't get out of their own way.
They are. If you go to, like, Twinkie Town, which is our equivalent of Covering the Corner, it is just sad over there. it's how we feel in the off season because they're just so bad. And
how are they so bad? I mean, obviously, injuries sucks. Yeah, that's true. Injuries have been sapping them. Simmons got COVID.
Weirdly enough, when he didn't get a vaccine, but, you know, it's fine.
But, you know, like, they seem like they should be good, but the pitching's not there either. And the bullpen,
yeah, and it's not just Buxton either. They have Luis Arraez, who's injured, Alex Kirilloff, Edward Kalina, they're all injured. Yeah, so they're relying on a bunch of these rookies who are obviously going to be inconsistent. Like, Trevor Larnach is up. He's really good, and he's not been good since he came up, but he's only in a couple games.
I think they'll be okay, is the thing. If they can get back to 500, and we just saw this in 2019, if they can get back to 500 by the end of June, they'll be fine. But, like, will they? I don't know. Like, everyone's still hurt, and, like, the pitching looks fine. But is it is Michael Pineda really a 2.43 ERA guy? His fielding independent pitching is 4.15. I just feel like there's going to be some, you know, narrowing on that. J.A. Happ? I don't know. Maybe. Probably not. They're employing a lot of slow dudes in the outfield, so, you know, balls will drop. Yeah, you know, we've seen it firsthand when you have great pitching and you have bad outfield. So, yeah, the division really is, Royals are coming back to earth. It's really wide open for the Indians. And now with the, we were talking about the bullpen before, they're very much built in many ways kind of like that Rays team. Like, they don't have a punchy offense. They have some young guys with upside. Maybe they'll find their own Randy Arozarena somewhere. Who knows? Maybe his name is Harold Ramirez. There's no reason to – at this point, obviously, it's May 10th. I see no reason why they couldn't win the division still.
Oh, of course, yeah.
I see many reasons why they couldn't, but, you know.
Yeah. And no matter what, like, I'd rather be the team that's ahead and being chased than – Oh, and we chased the Twins. Like last year, it was fun chasing, or in 2019, it was fun chasing down the Twins, but also they got there and just fell right back immediately and missed the playoffs. But yeah, the Royals have been fun. Like they were leading the division. They had the best record in baseball at the beginning of May. 10 days later, they have like the 20th worst record in baseball. So life comes at you fast in baseball, especially when you go 1 of 9 over 10 games and lose 8 in a row. It doesn't exactly go great. So, I mean, Minnesota, they can always just rebound and go on a big winning streak, because I'm sure they will at some point. We just kind of
they get to play the Royals and Tigers, you know? I mean, they get to play bad teams too. And, like, you know, it's just you dig yourself a hole and you got to dig yourself out. We saw Cleveland have to do that several times over the last many years. They were just benefited from the division stinking, basically. So, does the division stink now? Well, at this point, I can't even tell, because, like, you look at the record, you're like, yes, they do. But do they? They do. But do they?
So I think. Yeah, I think overall they do now, but it's like a thing, you know, they can be better than what they are, but right this second they're pretty bad. And so Cleveland does have where they play. So they have a little West Coast trip. They play the Cubs,
yeah, Mariners, the West Angels. Coast of Chicago. That's right, the West like, Coast of Lake Michigan. Here we go.
That's their transfer station in Chicago. And then they're in the Mariners, Angels. Then they're back again. So the Twins, Tigers, Blue Jays are mixed in there, and then White Sox. So, I mean, like after that, after June, we could see like – that's a lot of games playing your own division. And if they could stay hot for a month, and then also the White Sox are beat up and the Twins are whatever the hell's going on over there, like they could be in a really good position by the end of June, just to set up for figuring out what they need by the time the trade deadline rolls around and being the team that's on top and being chased as opposed to 20 games back trying to catch up. So I think it's a you can't ask for much better position considering what they did this offseason, which was essentially nothing. And they have such a low payroll, like, you can't ask to be better than a game back and have a chance to play the team leading you in a couple of weeks. So,
a team that, again, was built on its offense in a year where they've lost, first of all, two of the bigger contributors. The third one is going to come back to earth because that MVP run he went on last year was insane. But also in a year where they've made the ball even harder to hit. So, for a team that is very much built on pitching, it's very well placed for Cleveland to squeak by them, I think. And, you know, same thing with the Twins, right? Bomba Squad is being kind of neutered in a way because they can't go Bomba quite so much.
What would they be called now? They're obviously not the Bomba Squad. They're like the Flamba the Bimble Squad. Like
a Bimble Squad? Bumble Squad? Bumble Squad.
There we go. We got it. Let me write that down for show title. Bumble Squad. There we go.
Google that before you just to check the SEO. You need to make sure.
Bumblesquad.com. Make sure it doesn't go anywhere illicit. We're good. All right. Beautiful. Cool.
Oh, and it does. Good. Perfect. All right. Let's use it. All right. Great.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. So Cleveland, like you mentioned, they have a quote unquote West Coast trip, which includes a nice little trip to Chicago in the middle, just, you know, to see the sights and catch some wind or whatever they have in Chicago. That's kind of a weird one because it's at 6 p.m. tomorrow and then a day game the day after. And then from there, they go to Seattle, which is just a layover,
by the way.
Yeah. That's the word I'm looking for, not transfer station. Yeah. And then they play, two 10 p.m. games and a 9 p.m. game, which is just awful. For some reason,
yeah,
for the
one Twins. One of them's like a weekend game. I love those. I was watching that over the weekend.
You like 9 p.m. weekend games?
Hell yeah. I don't do anything.
I guess that one will be over by midnight at least. So it's not
the one,
so,
the
so
one person I hang out with is out of town. So, I mean, whatever. I'm still kind of, I'm vaccinated. I'm still kind of bubbling here. I don't know. Like, so, you know.
But yeah. And then they have all so Sunday too is 4:10, which is late for a Sunday because we're over here. But yeah. And so I think the most notable thing coming up this week, I mean, the Cubs, obviously, they have some connection to that team a little bit. I don't know when I'm going to let that go, but it's not yet. They're still connected to them for the 2016 World Series, but also from 2016. So if everything stays the way it is, based on what Roster Resource projects, which is basically just going by the order of the pitchers, Justice Sheffield, they should play him on Saturday, I think.
That's fun.
Yeah. He's one of the ones they traded for Andrew Miller, obviously in 2016, which this will be the first time they've played any pitcher from that series, which I thought was kind of interesting because Fire Eisen, he's actually on the Brewers now, which is cool because he grew up in Milwaukee, but or around the area in Wisconsin. And then Ben Heller is on Arizona, but he hasn't made the majors this year. I think he might be injured. And then, of course, Justice Sheffield was on the Yankees for 1 year and then went to Seattle for a couple of years. And that's where he is now. And they don't play him very often. So this will be the first time they face him, which I think will be cool. He was always one of my favorite pitching prospects when he was here. And then I was obviously okay with him leaving because it meant we had Mr. Andrew Miller here, which was cool. But yeah, what sticks out to you for these coming up series, I guess, between the
Well, I got to say, just peripherally, I've really been enjoying Chris Bryant's kind of screw you Cubs kind of tour he's going on this year. He really hates that team, it seems like. He's just so good. He's killing it. He's having maybe the best year of his career. And you're just like, yeah, dude, hell yeah, screw that team. Yeah, beat him up. Get him. Oh, yeah, I don't know. The Cubs are still a neat team. They will continue to be a team that just I marvel at because this team was supposed to be good for a decade. And they're just like, we got to blow it up. It's over. We're done.
Yeah, and this is the year they manipulated service time and went through all that just so they can get this year for Chris Bryant, which is backwards.
And they're currently, third place? Yeah, third place in a 500 team. So, no, I think it'll be fun. I mean, I'm sad we're not going to see Kyle Hendricks. I think he's one of the most fun pitchers to watch pitch. It's like watching a much better version of, what's his name, on Cleveland. He pitched over the weekend. Aaron Civale. Thanks, man, for the help.
You're welcome. I was here for you. I'm just trying to make the edit easier because I don't know it either. So I'm just waiting. I'll find the blank space and.
The team's not very good at this point. They have a couple fun players to watch, though, so that's always fun. And then it's always fun to watch the Mariners because like they exist in this area outside of time, and you're like, what's keeping going on up there? I don't know. They're always bad. Like they're above 500 this time, but they're still in third place. So I'd be neat to see how some of these younger guys, because they've been rebuilding forever, it seems like. So it'd be nice to see if we can see any of the younger guys actually play, like Taylor Trammell. It's a shame we can't see any of the actual good, the big names they have. But like you mentioned, it'll be neat to see Justice Sheffield and some of the other guys. It's, two teams that aren't very good, but they're two teams that we don't see very much of. So that's always exciting to see because I like to watch baseball a lot. But after I watch one Cleveland game, I usually end up watching, like on a Friday, I'll watch a Cleveland game and then it'll be 10:30. And since I don't go anywhere, I'll put on the Dodgers game or something and half watch it. Or I'll just, Shohei Ohtani or something like that. So
I was going to mention that because, the Mariners are always there. They're always a late game, but I'm always watching the Dodgers or Angels. There's no reason to watch the Mariners.
Like, I can't watch the Dodgers or the Angels? Well, I guess I'll watch the Padres.
Or the Giants.
I guess I'll watch the Giants. I just got to go through the list. Like, God damn it. Come on. None of you on the West Coast. So, yeah. They're definitely the last choice when it comes to watching that late game. And so,
which I think could change pretty soon because they have Julio Rodriguez and, like you said, Jared Kelenic, who a fake account tricked John Heyman today and he thought they were coming up, but that didn't actually happen. And also, for anyone who follows prospects, Sam Haggerty used to be a Cleveland Indians prospect and now he's on the Mariners and not very good, but that's another interesting thing. I think he was DFA'd at one point, went to the Mets, didn't make it there, or he did make it there for a couple of games. And then he was actually pretty good for the Mariners last year, and this year he's not very good so far. But that's somebody who was in the system for a while, which is kind of neat. Like you said, Taylor Trammell, he was another very slight Cleveland connection. He was part of the three-team deal for Trevor Bauer. It was the same deal, but it was the Padres that sent Fernando Reyes for Taylor Trammell.
Hey, let me get on this. Do that? Yeah. Why are you here?
Are you going to make a trade? I got this guy over here.
Hey, what's up, guys? Are you busy? Let me get some of this. I got a player. Oh, doesn't matter. Trades? What do you think? Tradesies?
He's like I was that kid with Pokemon cards because I just wanted to trade. I didn't know what I was doing. I traded to Starmie once and I cried afterwards because he wouldn't give it back. I feel like that's basically what the Padres were in that deal.
Did you trade for the Starmie?
No, I traded my Starmie away. I didn't know what rarities were. It was only a diamond. It was basically worthless, but it was mine and I liked it. And he didn't give it back after I regretted the trade. So,
well, you're stupid. You're a stupid little kid. And that's why you can't trust stupid little kids.
And I also traded, again, I think I'm the Padres here. I traded I don't know if they were Burger King, but there's some kind of promotional card where they were just like full art cards. You couldn't use them in the game or anything, obviously. But I traded a bunch of regular cards for those because I thought they were cooler. But also they were like just these cheap perforated things that you ripped off and they were just garbage. But I traded a bunch anyway. So what I'm saying is that's the equivalent, I think, of trading Taylor Trammell for Fran Reyes, which nobody asked him to be involved. Cleveland got Yasiel Puig and they were good to go.
I'll take it, baby.
But they also got those out.
Trades?
So.
Yeah.
Trades? All right. Yeah, it'll be nice. Chris Flexen's also an interesting pitcher for them. They have a bunch of not great, but they have so many interesting players. Like Justin Dunn is another
one. We've been saying they have some interesting pitchers for 150 years.
It's like, always so close.
Like, it's like, obviously, they had Felix Hernandez, but then behind him, there's always like, this guy could be pretty good.
They had Cliff Lee for a year. That was fun.
Yeah, that was a neat little, his little tour of the Pacific Northwest. I don't know, refresh himself in the forests for a time, and then he journeyed down to, and then he was traded down to Texas? Was that trip? Yeah.
Yeah, he went to Texas and then, for the half season, and then he was.
For Justin Smoke, one of my favorite named person in the history of baseball. Because he was all smoke, no fire. Bad hitter. Oh. It'll be a fun couple of series. Not exciting, probably, but there's just some magic about these late night games. I don't know.
Twitter's always fun. Everybody gets weird. I like that.
Well, it'll be great, too, because, like, this didn't happen last year. The announcers aren't traveling with the team. And so, like, Matt Underwood.
They're going to be dying.
They're just going to be so punch drunk by the end of the game. Tom Hamilton is going to be pissy.
So he doesn't go either? He stays back, too?
I wasn't sure if he goes.
I know the TV guys do.
I was into Reds game, I think it was, or some game a couple weeks ago. And he said, "Boy, Rosie, we got to get back out on the road." But yeah, they're not traveling.
Oh,
yeah. So.
They are going to be. Oh man, because there's not going to be any adjustment period for them. They're either going to have to sleep or.
You got to get up now at 10, start calling the game or whatever. Yeah.
Rick Manning's going to start swearing at like 3 in the morning. It's going to be
They're going to be. This is usually when I have my scotch. This is bullcrap.
I like the booth now. Air?
Yeah, I have my scotch every night at 10:30. I've been doing it for years. I usually do it local time, but look where I am, local time.
It's the second inning now. I'm doing it anyway.
It's in my contract. Yeah, that's right. It is his contract.
Well, there you go. I like how in the booth now, because I think him, Matt Underwood, and Andre Knott are all just in the same room. And like they'll joke, and in the background, you can hear Andre laugh in the distance. That's always my favorite part because he's trying not to get in the way, but you can hear him because he's there. That's really good.
During games, like during home games, he's wandering around just doing nothing.
But when they're away, they're in a different room, and you can hear ha way in the back. That's so funny. It's happened more than once, and I love it. I think that'll do it for us, man. We talked about everything, got the games coming up.
We did it, everyone. We talked about everything.
Everything in the world. We talked about Mitch Haniger. We forgot. That's the one thing we forgot. We talked about him. There we go. We covered it. We're done.
Covered. Got him. Kyle Seager. You know, he's still there.
He's still there. Oh,
I mean, still hitting 250.
He's not very good. I guess he was pretty good. He's young, but.
You know, they got players. I mean, hey, Cubs, they still got big Tony Rizzo, huh? Hey, Tony. Hey, yo.
There you go. They got Matt Duffy for some reason. I'm not sure why.
Somehow hitting 255, 288, 518 gives you a 123 OPS plus. There's Javier Baez for you, baby. Swinging at everything and more and more. Jock Peterson. Remember how many times we wrote how we wanted Jock Peterson on Cleveland?
I do. I tried to build that into existence. I'd take him now. I mean, he's not very good, but
I'll say this. I don't understand the idea behind getting rid of Kyle Schwarber and then getting Jock Peterson. They're the same person.
I don't think it saved him much money either.
Well, let's see. Jock Peterson, he signed a contract for $7 million. And then we pop over here. Now, I did see Kyle Schwarber hit a ball a quarter mile for a walk-off home run a little while back, and that was really cool. But he's being paid $10 million. So
they saved a tiny bit, I guess, if that's what their goal is. But and I also forgot, too, on the Cubs, they have Tony Walters. That's another Cleveland prospect connection.
Do they really? Oh, that's fun. I've always enjoyed Tony Walters. I interviewed him on a podcast a long time ago.
Oh, did you? That's cool.
Nice kid. Yeah, back when he was still in like the Double-A or something like that. Nice guy.
Yeah, he was really good for his rookie season in Colorado, and then Colorado happened to him. But
He got Colorado-ized.
Yeah, that happens. All right, Marion, that'll do us for us this week. If you haven't already, subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. Find us on coveringthecorner.com, at Facebook on Covering the Corner, which we finally got our name changed on there. So you can actually just look for Covering the Corner now, which it only took 20 appeals through Facebook's very good functional process, but it's there.
SEO, baby, we did it.
On Twitter at Cover the Corner. Find me on Twitter at MattROY, Merritt at Merrill Lunch, like Merrill Lynch with the lunch. Merritt, talk to you next week.
I'll be there.